Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Shane's not here tonight because I'm in Glasgow. I'm at the CHI conference. A conference which is too big, if you ask me. I don't know what the number is. 3,500, 4,000 people, something like that, of people who are working in human-computer interaction, interaction design in its widest sense. And I'm here with Rachel Jacobs, who is an artist and a researcher based in Nottingham and London.
Yes.
Thank you for joining me.
Hello.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in London. I moved to Nottingham when I was 18 for university and stayed for 26 years and sort of half moved back to London quite recently, so I'm in a bit of shock.
And what did you want to be when you were growing up?
An artist, yeah, or a dancer. I was more interested in dance in those days, and now I seem to spend more time sitting down on a computer, as I think a lot of us do, than I expected.
So why an artist or a dancer?
The dancing thing, I think when I was growing up, I just danced all the time. I'd dance down the street. And I absolutely loved dance. And then when I went to university, I studied a really interesting course that was called Creative Arts that was really interdisciplinary. And that kind of opened up the way I thought about art and creativity. And it felt like I was able to use whichever media I needed to use for the concept or the idea that I was playing with. So so now I would call myself an interdisciplinary artist. I haven't used dance for a very long time, although sort of movement elements come in, and I'm very interested in kind of embodied experience, the senses and how we kind of feel things physically. So that's still there. I've always been interested in that. My mother's an artist and my dad's a scientist, so I think actually a friend said to me yesterday that I was some kind of weird hybrid that came out of that mix, which I think is possibly true.
So did you finish that degree?
Yeah, did that degree when I was young.
Yep, then what?
Then I set up an artist collective with three others called Active Ingredient. And we were going for 20 years. We got interested in the internet in 1996 when it was quite early days. Images were still quite exciting on the internet, and we were interested in how, as artists, we could kind of work with it and what we could do with it. So we just kind of played with it and experimented and did workshops and tried to train other artists and unemployed people in using the internet and finding something that excited them about it. And then it kind of evolved from there. And then as new technologies emerged, we carried on trying to be creative with it. So we worked with streaming media in the late 90s. We kind of set up a thing a bit like YouTube before YouTube. Then we got into mobile phones in 2005 and started working with the University of Nottingham then. And we were interested in it from a health perspective, how these things that you could carry around with you could help with health. Again, quite early days. And increasingly work with scientists as well. So sort of combining art, technology and science together in a big mix and seeing what happened. But the key for me has always been the idea that I wanted to see whether technology and science could move people in some kind of way, in a kind of sensory way, and make the hair stand up at the back of your neck and have some element of magic in it that isn't just about, oh, cool, that's a cool gimmick, that's a cool technology or whatever. So that's kind of where it all came from, was trying to push all these different things together and see what happened.
Did the scientists that you were working with in those early days think you're a bit mad?
Sort of, but I think we've, as Active Ingredients, I'll say we, because that was a collective, and myself as an independent artist more recently, I think we've been very lucky in the fact that scientists often feel that there is a gap between what they're doing and how they communicate it to people who aren't scientists or aren't technical. And so often they've been a little bit relieved that someone's come along who's interested, who wants to do something that adds a bit of... I mean, I wouldn't use the word magic necessarily when I'm working with scientists, but adds that other layer of kind of emotional connection or sensory connection to what they're doing, that people can actually feel wowed and excited by what they're doing.
I just wrote down the next question to ask. I realise it's a bit weird, but I'll ask it anyway.
Go for it.
What does art bring to the picture?
Yeah, so that's difficult, because then it gets into what is art, which is a sort of endless ancient question. But I think that when you approach something without an agenda, without the kind of rules and methods that you might have as a scientist or a technologist, or even any other discipline, really. You can make different kinds of connections. You maybe your intention is different. It's quite important for me that the majority of the time the stuff that I do and make people don't have to pay for, and that it's actually they're experiencing it for the sake of an experience, that it's about enriching your life or your way of thinking about the world, and that's it. That the agenda isn't to make money or necessarily even to pass on information, even though quite a lot of the work with scientists does have an element of that in there. But that's not the reason why I'm doing it. The reason is to somehow open something up in the world that wouldn't be there otherwise. So I think art, for me, is about intention and a certain freedom of thinking and being in the world.
So I've been talking about your work for the longest time, and I hadn't met you or didn't know about you until this morning.
Which is
so
lovely.
The Conversation Between Trees.
Mm.
Tell us about that.
So that was a project that started when I took another project to Brazil, which was a heart rate project with mobile phones. And the person who was organising the festival was doing a big... Brazilian guys who were doing a big project in the Amazon rainforest, and said, would you do some stuff with data and technology in the Amazon rainforest? And I thought about it and thought, that's really cool, but no, because I've never been there, I don't feel like I can. So from that, we talked about what that kind of means and what we could do. So we kind of developed this idea of a conversation between trees and between different forests in different parts of the world. So we ended up doing a whole series of school exchanges and research trips and thinking around what was happening in the forests in Brazil, what had happened in the forests in the UK with industrialisation and our kind of historical and environmental context, what's happening now. And as a result of that, we set up sensors there's sensors in a tree in the Mata Atlantica, which is the coastal forest. So we didn't actually go to the Amazon in the end. It's the coastal forest. It's kind of a cloud forest. It's where the clouds gather, and then they go in and rain in the Amazon on the Atlantic coast. And then in forests in the UK, so there was, and that one actually moved, so we had sensors in different forests, but we started in Sherwood Forest, which is near Nottingham and is iconic all over the world, I think. we captured data from the forests for the weather, so it was temperature, humidity, atmospheric pressure, also light, decibels and carbon dioxide in both forests. And the sensors were live, so it's sending this data online. I think it was every minute. It was a long time ago, so I can't remember the detail. And we visualised that data in strange ways. But they were, the visualisations reflected a lot of the imagery and the experiences we had of being in the forests. And actually, even though we'd programmed the way it was going to work, when it wasn't until we fed the data in that we knew what was going to happen. And it really did feel like the trees were kind of talking, or at least the what was going on around them. And in a way, we're trying to reveal these invisible thing processes that humans can't normally see, but we can sense. And through the visualization, they kind of came to life. So in the gallery, we had the Brazilian tree projected on one wall and then the UK tree on the other wall. And it did look like they were talking to each other. And people stayed for a very, very long time. And some people stayed for hours. People came back. It's very meditative. It was a really interesting process to see how that came to life and how people experienced it, and they appeared to get a real emotional connection to these different places, these remote places. The exhibition, we had a small exhibition in São Paulo, and then it toured around the UK. In the centre of this exhibition was a machine that was a round machine made of wood that it was a bit like a scanner, but it drew. Carbon dioxide data annually from 1958 to 2011 when the exhibition and tour happened. But it scorched the data into paper as circular graphs. So it ended up being
quite big.
Yeah, they were big pieces of paper. It was one circle per sheet for each year, and then all the sheets were hung up so that you could walk past them and look through them. And they were really ever-increasing circles. And as I think most people know now, that the carbon dioxide levels are getting bigger and bigger, higher and higher. In 2011, it was around 400 parts per million. We're already up to about 420, I think. We're getting that way. So actually looking back on it now, I kind of think, oh, wow. You know, we were at the edge of the page by 2011 because the circles were so big when we'd started with I'm making a shape with my hands, but it was quite small.
And they were
circles.
Hung up as if it was a tree.
Yes, yeah.
Being chopped into sections.
Yeah, so it referenced tree rings. And it was really important for us as well that it was burning and you could smell the burning, and the machine rattled and vibrated as it kind of sort of spoke the data as well as kind of burning it. So it had lots of kind of layers to it. And the whole exhibition did, because that was the kind of global view of the changes that were happening while we were having this minute-by-minute view of what was happening in the forest. Carbon dioxide levels were relatively high during the day. Obviously, at night, they completely went sky high. I mean, it was quite amazing. You could see as darkness came, the carbon dioxide levels increasing, and you got a real sense of actually what really does happen, and that it's not all made up by scientists. This is real. Even though some of the audience felt that this was all a big conspiracy. And one person said, isn't it made up to sell boilers? Which is interesting. So one of the things that is interesting for
because
me...
Because it's going to get colder.
Yeah. I think there's such confusion around this data and the narratives of what is happening with climate change, with environmental change, deforestation. And in some ways, we were sort of seeing this as a set of clues that people could piece together and try and create their own kind of narratives and stories around it that made sense to them. And that particularly worked with the circular graphs, the tree rings, if you will, that people went through, and they were all marked with the date. They were kind of embossed. The date was embossed. and people were looking for their date of birth.
I was going to say, did anybody not go to their birth year?
I think not. I think most people went for their birth year, or then they kind of said, oh, when I was married in that year, oh, I wonder why that year is a bit different from the other years. There was a couple of glitches and a couple of years where it didn't kind of go up so much. And people started to tell stories and imagine their lives into it. And I think that was quite important, was how people kind of tell the story of something that's so big and so complicated. And certainly then people really seemed to struggle, particularly in the venues we were going to, because it was actually exhibited in forests.
Now you hung it up in forests?
Yeah, so the actual exhibition with the projections and the machine and the paper hanging from the ceiling was all in kind of visitor centres or galleries that were actually existed in forests. We also had a phone app that people could take out into the forest, so they could actually leave the gallery, go out into the forest, and that had the visualisation on it, and a little app where it asked you what you felt the temperature was, and the light levels and the sound levels. And people said it was a bit like Avatar. They suddenly started to see the forest in a different way, and it kind of came to life in a way that they wouldn't normally experience the forest. Not everyone said that. Some people said, oh, I didn't like having technology in the forest, I just wanted to be in the forest. But they were people that were sort of already engaged in that, kind of being totally in the feel of it, I suppose.
Why? Why did you do that?
The app or the whole thing?
The whole thing.
So going back to the discussion we had about whether we could go to the Amazon and make an app about the Amazon, I think the reason why we felt we couldn't was because we didn't know enough about it. We didn't understand really ourselves as artists coming from the UK what was going on with forests in Brazil. And I read an article by a logger, I think, or it was an interview with a logger, who was saying, you know, all these people all around the world telling us what to do, we need to industrialise ourselves. We need to do well, so we're going to cut down our forests. So I felt that this conversation needs to happen. And with the schoolwork that we did in parallel, the kids actually had conversations with each other about the forests on their doorsteps, what it meant to them, how they were changing, what had changed, the history. And so they were learning about it and sharing it with other people. And I think it's in the act of sharing what we know about things, or what we're learning about things, that we really come to know it, and to, again, tell stories about it that are meaningful to us, because we're telling someone else who doesn't know or had never seen it before. I think also, this is a preoccupation that I still have, is how do we understand data more than just the numbers? How does it become meaningful to us? How do we actually have an emotional investment in this information that is actually going to change our lives, and is changing our lives right now? But there's a disconnect between what the scientists tell us and what our experience as being in a forest is, or our environment changing. Particularly if we're in urban environments, a lot of the kids that we work with in Nottingham and Rio were in quite urban environments and didn't necessarily go and spend time in the forest at the end of their street or around, you know.
Because if you had that same 70, whatever it was, year record,
yeah,
on a spreadsheet and told people just to spend an hour looking at it,
yeah,
they would pick up trends and things.
Yeah.
But you're saying there's so much more to it than that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think being able to really feel what that means, rather than intellectually, logically, trying to get some kind of understanding of it and make a decision based on it about how we're going to live our lives, or whether we care about forests at all, is really difficult. And actually the climate scientist I work with, called Carlo Bontempo, who used to be at the Met Office in the UK, he said that there's a kind of process where we need a combination of emotion and logic in order to kind of really act and really understand what's happening. And I think that's really important to remember, that we need to use both bits of our experience and our ways of getting knowledge in order to really get something that's really complicated and really difficult. And I think my feeling is, and the research I've done, is that it's just not enough to know about climate change or know that carbon dioxide's increasing in the atmosphere. And actually, most people aren't literate in what this is. I mean, so many people I met through the exhibition didn't know what carbon dioxide was and got it muddled up with oxygen. To be honest, I probably wouldn't have known before I started this process. So if you're not a scientist, if you're not necessarily particularly good at numbers and graphs, how do you make sense of all this information that's out there? It's got to have that emotional connection, I think.
So you had that vision of it's come from that.
Mm.
If I was a scientist with some data about something, how would I go about artifying it? That's not a word. Is it a matter of finding an artist or some artists, giving them the data and saying, can you use this to inspire some work? What's that process?
It's very difficult because obviously I'm only one artist and my arts collective is a particular kind of group with a particular approach, and many artists do things differently. There is this kind of sector of artists in all over the world who are working particularly with data and particularly interested in how data can be made meaningful and express more than just the numbers and just the kind of abstract notions of what they represent, and sort of to dig in also into the kind of uncertainties and difficulties of what those numbers mean. So yes, if you wanted to go down that route, you could try and find an artist whose expertise was particularly around working with data. But I think narrative and storytelling is kind of key to this approach, and how we find stories that are meaningful in the data, how we ask questions around how that data really affects the world or people, or depending on what your approach is or your discipline. And that doesn't need to be word stories. So with A Conversation Between Trees, it was a visual story. There were some kind of words involved, and there was also the sensory stuff. But it's telling a story. It's kind of revealing different layers, multiple interpretations of the data. And that's very difficult for science because obviously, actually, you're not allowed to. You have to stick to the method, the scientific method, and be very clear about what you're doing. So that's why maybe bringing an artist in to work with you is kind of useful, because like I said, actually, we were often welcomed because we could tell the other story that the scientists are not meant to be telling because it's not rigorous enough. But I think also working with the people who are going to be affected by the data is absolutely essential to kind of opening that up and finding out what this data actually means to them in their lives, in their bodies, in the world around them, if that makes sense.
Is there a sweet spot of fidelity? I don't know what the other side of it is, emotion or something else.
Yeah. I think there is, and it's something I did a PhD as a result of A Conversation Between Trees at the University of Nottingham, who's been partners on the work that I've been doing. And that was one of the things that I was looking at in the PhD, is this kind of, this trying to get this balance, but kind of between authenticity and creativity or artistic interpretation. You know, there's telling the story, but if you go too far from the data and actually what it's telling you, then it's lost. And it's a very hard balance, and I don't think I've always got there. How does it remain meaningful in a scientific way and keep its authenticity. And I think people can sort of know, even if they don't understand the science, if it's too abstracted and fictional and kind of overexcited, then it loses something, and you lose your story as well. You lose the reality of your story in a way.
You'd have to be careful not to embellish.
It's really difficult, because obviously what a scientist sees as embellishing and what an artist sees as embellishing. But I think it's about really understanding what the meaning of it is. So one of the issues with CO2 is that people didn't care about the numbers. They cared about the ever-increasing circles. They cared about the size of the circles and the year and what that meant to them. And so it's kind of extracting that rather than worrying too much. Then no one remembered the parts per million in 2008 necessarily. I don't remember it. But
I don't need to for it to have me to have impact on me.
Yeah, exactly, because actually seeing the scale of change and the time of change, and that was really key as well, was temporality, the experience of things changing over time, which you don't get from a chart. I mean, you get a sense, if you follow this line, it goes like this, but to experience the change as a temporal thing, even by walking along these hanging discs with the ever-increasing circles, people could actually feel it change in a sense, rather than just look at it and go, oh yeah, that represents time. So it's kind of getting the understanding what people take away from that and what story they then tell themselves afterwards. Oh, I remember that it was this big in 2011.
In the room next door to us, you've got a fairground machine?
Mm-hmm. Kind of, yeah.
A prediction machine. It's actually two machines.
Yes, it is. It's called the prediction machine, but there is actually the prediction machine, which is like the old fortune-telling machines that we used to have at the end of the pier in the Victorian days in Britain and many places in the world. And actually, it is slightly based on the film Big, which I don't know if you've seen, but it was an American Hollywood film with this machine that you could, that would just give you a fortune. Anyway, it's quite playful. But the second machine was added later. It's called the Promises Machine, and the first machine, you receive a prediction about the future, and the second machine, you're invited to give a promise in response. So it adds a level of kind of commitment from you. It's not just a passive experience, although the first one isn't either, because you have to power it yourself and it's quite hard.
So you turn a dial,
yeah,
to say how old you are.
Yeah.
And what are you doing with that?
So you're, again, it's trying to place you in the picture, and it did partly come from this thing in a conversation between trees when people were looking for their birth year. The idea that if you know how old you are in 30 years' time when the prediction is four, then you can at least picture it yourself. The problem is that a lot of older people kind of get quite upset about the fact that they feel that maybe they won't be around in 30 years' time, and it's quite a shock for people to actually, even though, obviously if we counted 30 years onto our year now, we would know how old we were, but actually to see it in print, it's quite a shocking thing to people.
What did you say? What did your printer help?
It says
you'll be compost.
No, not quite. So it tells you how old you're going to be in 30 years' time, and then it predicts what the world will be like based on the weather today. So it actually adds 3.7 degrees to the temperature now. We did want to do a kind of estimate of the wind and the precipitation, the rain, but in the end, it's just so difficult to model that the scientists said just stick with the temperature. At least that gives you a kind of picture. So it adds on 3.7 degrees, and each kind of weather range has a set of written scenarios of what the weather or the world will look like in the future based on those scenarios. And they've all been written by people who've participated in workshops with me, so it's been quite a creative process just to get those descriptions of the world, the predictions, kind of written up. So you get your age, you get your prediction, and then it asks you to make a promise.
It gives you a little slip of paper.
Yeah, you get a little slip of paper. So you put in your age on the dial, then you have to turn this handle, which powers the machine.
Is it actually?
It powers actually the speakers in the machine and the screen. So to actually power the whole machine would probably take half of this conference. a laptop's really hard to power by hand. I mean, as soon as the video kicks in with the screen, I don't know if you noticed.
It got harder.
Yeah, it gets harder. The screen comes on, it shows you what the weather is now, what the weather will be like in 30 years' time. It's the temperature and a kind of written description. Because in the testing, we found that people, again, just didn't look at the numbers. They just didn't remember even seeing the numbers, which is quite interesting. Obviously, the scientists, people who are experts in numbers, notice, but the majority of people don't. And we've been showing it in public libraries and kind of quite kind of open public places, so it hasn't necessarily been experts, climate scientists and things. I'm the same, so because I've worked with technology and science, I tend to see in words and images more. And then, so that appears, then little videos appear, which I don't think you can hear so well in the conference, but there's people talking about climate changing over their lifetimes. Or not. I mean, a few people say they haven't experienced it at all. And then eventually it says, stop turning the wheel, which people are normally quite relieved about. And then this little slip of paper comes out with your prediction on. And then it says, go to the promises machine. If you want to put in a promise, then please do. You put that in. It asks you your year of birth, I think, and then gives you some information about how the weather's changed and how it might change in the future. And actually, there's a secret that people don't know here, but you can also sign up to get a gift in the post. And what I've been doing is, it will no longer be a secret, but I've been sending people who put their promises in, their promises inscribed into clay about a year later. And it's a kind of surprise, I think. People don't realise it's coming. And that kind of makes it all concrete somehow, and they're kind of left with that.
And presumably, the fact that it's getting warmer,
yeah,
is it going to be enough to have them thinking about making changes? And then you're reinforcing those changes by getting them to say them.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't always say that it's getting warmer, because it really depends on what the weather is today and right now when you use the machine. So if the weather is average now, which it is at the moment in Glasgow, then...
It's pretty cold.
Yeah, but this is Glasgow. This is actually average for this time of year. So then it actually gives you the impression that in the future it will be not that much different. Now, that is quite contentious, because obviously, really, the overarching narrative is it's going to get worse and life's going to be pretty tough if we carry on this trajectory. But the thing with climate modelling is it's complicated and it's uncertain, and it's not always going to be awful, and there's going to be some days that are going to be normal.
Because last night it was 9 degrees and turned the handle and it told me it was going to be 13. I thought,
yeah,
all right.
But I think the thing of kind of putting your mind to the future and trying to work it out and asking yourself those questions, for me, I think that subtle approach is maybe does get into you and uses these things around emotion and kind of embodied experience. You're trying to work it out yourself. I think that's better, or at least that uses different ways of thinking about the future than someone just saying it's all going to be bad. You've got to get really, you've got to change your whole life and you've got to panic. So I think there's lots of different approaches to this, and different people respond in different ways. But to actually just start thinking and questioning, I think, is the beginning of kind of really rethinking what's going on in the world and why is it changing.
Especially with that stating the promise, because that's like the motivational interviewing approach of saying, saying out loud or writing down what you're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this other element of sending the promise back, which...
That's cool.
Yeah, it's kind of making it concrete. Yeah, and they're all handmade, which is kind of, and they look handmade, which is the point, really. So that's... I've got a little sort of letter set where you print them in.
But you have to do them all individually.
Yeah, I've done 100 so far, and sent them all back through the post. So I will send some of the ones back. I mean, not everyone puts their address in, obviously, and it's quite a commitment from them to kind of put their address in. But it was an experiment, really, that bit, just to see whether people would do it and how people would respond, getting this throwaway thing that they put into a digital interface back as a concrete thing. And it's wrapped in muslin and it's got a printed drawing that I've drawn that's kind of an imaginary future machine, which is actually my next project. So I'm building a new machine now.
One of the things that it does expose is that conflict of between the weather and the climate.
Yeah.
Because it's too easy to say, where's this global warming? It's cold today.
Yeah.
A bit of global warming would do us good. But it is kind of exposing that. So even if I'm thinking, oh, that's not bad.
Yeah.
That's kind of not the whole story, is it?
Yeah.
And it is making me think about that.
Yeah. And I think the Promises Machine also, because it sort of explains a bit more for the people who get to that point. And there's a graph, actually, of the central England temperatures. I think we started in the 1800s, but it's actually the oldest temperature data set in the world, and it goes back to the 1600s. And so it's trying to, again, it's about having lots of different clues that you're asked to piece together, so no one's telling you what to think and what all this means. I'm kind of revealing them and as a kind of story. But it's not a very clear story because it's not a clear story. And it's up to all of us to work it out and piece it together, I think. And that may fail. It might not be explicit enough. And for some people, they might not like that. I did have some people with a conversation between trees saying, I don't get in 5 minutes, so what's the point in it? And I think that's very interesting as well, because I think we are living in a society where if it's not a soundbite, if it's not sort of rammed, you know, you're not hit over the head with something, it's very easy to ignore it because we're all so busy and we've got lots to think about and, you know, we've got to worry about whether we can pay our mortgages or eat or pay the rent or whatever our focus is.
Does it matter if people get it wrong? You wouldn't want someone to come away from your machines and think, oh, it's only going to be 13 degrees. That's good.
Yeah. People are going to get it wrong, whatever. I think it's a very difficult thing to communicate. And I'd rather people have thought about it on their own terms and tried to make sense of it in their own lives and then get angry or get defensive. And I think one of the issues with the more explicit way of talking about climate change is that however hard you whatever your intention is, not everyone gets the story. Not everyone reacts to fear or to the drama of it or the extinction story. And I mean, some of the research that's out there around how we create myths about the world shows that if you have a certain way of seeing the world, no matter what information you get and what fear that you might be, you know, how many pictures of polar bears dying, it's not going to affect you because you will either go into denial or it just doesn't fit with your story of the world.
Or I already know.
Yeah, or so I already know, so yeah. I'm doing
so
something.
So there's no point front-loading with doom.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that we just need to keep thinking about it and keep trying to work through it and understanding it and also that what we know about it is changing. It's changed so much since 2011 when I was doing Conversation Between Trees. Even now, since I built the prediction machine in 2015, we're in a completely different situation now. People are experiencing climate change in a much more dramatic way all over the world, and even the UK got off reasonably lightly so far, but it's beginning to be felt and experienced.
If you read it, would you have to find a bigger source of paper?
I'd have to start... I'd start smaller and do it at a different scale. Completely off those discs now. Yeah. I mean...
Just that in itself.
Yeah.
I would leave it on the same bit of paper and have, like, extensions or something for the last...
Yeah.
The last few years.
Yeah. In fact, actually, we did at the end of each exhibition, we did do 100 years into the future. So we started at 1958, and I think we did... Did we do... Oh, I can't remember how we did it. Did we do every... No, we didn't do 100. So we must have done it decades or something. So it was a complete... Zero was different and the scale was different. But it would be interesting, actually, to compare that to what's happened. And I think that's... Again, this leads to my current project, which is that feeling of the future unfolding and the changes unfolding, which the other two projects were very much of the time when they were made. But I've continued looking at this data and working with it, and I feel the change of our culture, of the way people are responding to it. And
this is the imaginary futures machine, is that what you said?
Yeah, it's called it's called Future Machine. So it's I've stuck with the machine theme.
Mm-hmm.
This is being built at the moment, again through workshops with local people in Nottingham and London so far. And it's a travelling machine that's going to go to 4 different places around the UK and hopefully return there every year as these places change. I mean, they'll change whether we have climate change or not, but we do have climate change, so they will be changing in a certain way, sadly. And it's a kind of witness to what's happening, and people can record things about the place changing every year and play back the recordings from the other places around the country. It's being designed and built at the moment, so the different elements that are going to be in there are still being kind of decided. It's going to be on a cart, trying to work out how to travel and move it across the country throughout the year.
Like an old style fairground.
Yeah, similar kind of theme. I was sort of thinking about barrel organs.
The barrel, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that it records and plays out. And I want it to be quite mystical, have a kind of sort of mysterious feel to it, a strange shape. I think it's going to be octagonal, which I'm not sure how that fits on a cart, but I'll get there. And the kind of thought experiment is what would happen if it returned to the same place for 30 years again, every year for 30 years. And if that community of people that are connected to that place kind of returned themselves every year, so that it becomes more of a ritual to connect you to that place and the changes that are happening and the changes that you've experienced. So it's much more about the unravelling of change over time than a kind of fixed point in time, and this is the data for now and this is the data that's projected or that's occurred in the past. It's about the kind of data unfolding and our experiences unfolding with it and how that relationship happens. So it's really early days, but it's really been fed by the other two projects.
I wonder if it'll have to... Let's say it does keep going for 30 years, this machine.
Mm.
I wonder how much the machine itself will have to change.
Yeah. I mean, as a research project, it's really exciting. There's lots of questions about how do you keep technology going for 30 years and how do we manage the data for 30 years? Who looks after it? I don't know if I'm going to be around in 30 years, so who manages it? So it's a really fun thought experiment, whether it actually happens or not. I mean, I hope it will happen for at least 5 to 10 years, but whether it can...
There's a sign on the sanctuary in Karori in Wellington, the eco sanctuary, and it says, "Welcome to our 500-year project."
Oh, brilliant. Oh, wonderful.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
Oh, that's very interesting, and I've been thinking about it a lot. And I read a really great book called The Eco Republic by... Oh, I'm not going to attempt to say who it's by because I'll get it wrong. I'm sorry, author of Eco Republic. That really talked about actually, and I think maybe this is something that you've been looking at, not thinking of sustainability as something that's different from how we live our lives and actually bringing it into our whole sense of being in the world and relating to the world. Obviously, I think we do have to do that at this point because our lives aren't like that. And I think it is very much about thriving. I think it's about loving and caring about places and being in the world and what that means to you and thinking about it, not dismissing where you are and how you relate to not just the other humans, but also the non-humans and the plants and the weather, the wind, the rain.
It's going to be really interesting to see how your future machine has quite different trajectories in the different places it goes to.
Mm. And it's going to a big park in London, a very small, very disused derelict park in Nottingham, a quarry in the Lake District, which is the north of England, in the mountains, and a woodland that's actually still common land, which in the UK we have this kind of... It goes back a really long time, this idea that some of the land is common and it's kind of managed by a group that kind of oversees its commonness. So they're really different places, and I think that's really exciting, and really different communities and people that care about those places who probably wouldn't feel the same kind of love for the park in Nottingham, or, you know, well, that's an assumption, who knows. But,
I wonder if in 5-10 years' time you'll be writing different bits of software for the different interpretations of where they might want to focus or go.
Yeah, I've not thought about that at all, whether... I mean, the idea is to bring people together, but actually, maybe we will, the way things happen, it will make it, it'll just become harder and harder. I mean, one of the problems we've got here is that particularly London is, I feel anyway, and I think it is kind of felt in the UK, that London has become nearly a city-state, is becoming more and more disconnected, particularly with the north of England. So one of the sort of feelings is that we is to try and bring these quite disparate communities together. I think it's happening all over the world with the kind of big cities and rural communities and rural environments versus urban environments. So, but we're all dealing with the same problem. So kind of, could a machine bring people together somehow?
I went to a canal boat festival. Went past a canal boat festival in London on the weekend.
Oh, great! Yeah.
And lots of the boats had badges of all the festivals they'd been to, and they were like covered with them.
Amazing.
It'd be nice to see the machine show its history.
One of the thoughts was actually to paint kind of depictions of where it's been, and to constantly round the machine and kind of update it every year. I mean, it will be recording sort of experiences, but I have been thinking about this. How do you mark where it's been in some way? I think that's really interesting, so that people don't actually have to interact with it. They can just look at it and see the story unfold somehow.
What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Oh, I think doing a PhD in computer science was a very unexpected thing, given my background. So that was quite exciting and hard work. I think a conversation between trees in some ways was it was a big project. It was over two continents. Great collaboration with lots of people and working with schools. And I think I really... it was a really lovely project in the end, I think, and it seems to have have kind of got out there, and I mean, I was amazed that you've been talking about it in New Zealand. That's quite, actually, that's made my day. That's quite an achievement, I think.
So we're writing a book of these conversations. It's called Tomorrow's Heroes. So you're in the mansion.
Oh, great.
What's the superpower that got you there?
I was talking about this with my partner, actually, the other day when we watched The Avengers. And we decided that I would be Gaia, and I would be a round ball. But that's not really what you're asking. I think caring about how people feel emotionally about the world is certainly what I think is important to my work, and I hope that it's what's useful about my work for other people who maybe don't necessarily want to do the same thing as me, but want to sort of try and approach things differently.
Do you think with the ever-increasing grandeur of Attenborough documentaries, is it becoming easier to engage people?
I think it's definitely, I mean, people are talking about the Attenborough effect, and I think it's changed things, definitely, that people have been able to see things differently, and they trust him. And I think that is part of the way our society is now, that we need a figurehead to trust, and they've sadly not trusted, well, we've sadly not trusted the scientists who are telling us these things in numbers and graphs. I think it still potentially suffers from this a kind of distancing problem, that it's still happening. You're still experiencing it passively on a screen, and it's happening on another side of the world. And
the BBC camera crew has gone on a big adventure to get that.
Yeah. Whereas actually feeling it in your favourite place, in the place where you go to be quiet, or to cry, or to dance, or whatever, you know, whatever you do outside, that's something else. And you know, or if your house gets flooded, or you experience some horrendous.
Have you sold a DIY conversation with trees?
I have thought about it.
Go and make one of these and hang it up in your garden. And
we did think about it. And actually, it's one of the things, sort of with the prediction machine as well. We thought about making mini prediction machines, and the idea of kind of getting little kits that you can send out. It's always been a bit difficult because the technology is complicated and expensive. And then there's also the thing of making more technology in the world to talk about it, which is, in terms of sustainability, is an ongoing discussion about how much you make and what you use in order to get your message across, or to engage with people, start conversations.
But if you think about it from could you do it in like Google Cardboard? What could you like do?
Yeah. Right. I think it's interesting.
Five questions to get through, we better hurry.
Wow.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No, not really.
That's okay, you don't have to. What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Wanting to be in the world, and all these things that I've talked about, engage, love the place I'm in, and communicate with people, have conversations, the ongoing conversation, I think.
What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
This 30-year project. Being around to finish it off.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
Oh, that's really hard. But I think, you know, changing the causes of climate change, human-induced climate change, would be a start. It's difficult because there's so many visible things in front of you, homelessness and other stuff, but I think that would be a start.
Tell you what was encouraging from a creative perspective was the imagination of the signs that the school kids had on the school strike for climate.
Really?
They were really good, and in terms of that narrative and the, this is about me and my future.
Yeah.
There were some really good stories in there.
I feel really hopeful, actually. And it's probably misplaced hope. But I feel that something has changed. And I hope it sticks and it has momentum. But it really does feel that, having been battling away at this since at least 2009 in terms of my work, I think it feels different now, this last year. I mean, partly because it's worse, but also because of this activism and this young people really, really getting it. Really, that's the future they're looking at.
Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I think trying to find out as much as possible and not feeling like there's one solution or one answer has been helpful to me, is to try and be open-minded and to find out as much as possible, and even the things that scare me, and the denial and the, you know, the attacks on, you know, this is a whole conspiracy, to actually investigate why people feel like that, or why, you know, or if that's what you believe, to really try and understand why people think this is happening, and to be open to asking questions, I think, is what's helped me.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. Each week we talk with somebody making a positive difference, and we try to see the world through their perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Rachel Jacobs, who is an artist and researcher from Nottingham and London. You can find Sustainable Lens on sustainablelens.org, broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and in all the other poddy sorts of places. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.